This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear. We've got a very interesting show today, I believe, because this is something that I'm getting. I've got several phone calls on this and emails and questions and panics and everything else. We're going to talk about some different subjects, but before we get to the main subjects, which is summertime coyote trapping, and if we have time, summertime beaver trapping. They are different. You don't have to be some super trapper to be able to pull that off. There's just some basic things you have to understand, because regardless of what you want, the natural system of coyotes and beavers are different in the summertime, and we're going to go over that. and we're going to look at different things like that. Now, before we do, I got an email from a friend of mine in Maine, John Shortle, and he always sends some pretty interesting stuff. And at the bottom of the email, we're talking about some other things, but at the bottom of the email, it says, finally, coyotes are, and I'm not even going to pretend to pronounce this because I know I'm going to get it wrong, but it's C-O-P-R-A-P-H-A-G-I-C, and meaning they eat feces. Of other animals to get trace elements of nutrients that they cannot get in their own diet. Texas Tech did a study, blind taste test with scat with 10 different kinds of animal droppings in squares and counted the tracks of coyotes. Cats won, paws down. Best regards, John. Now, to me, I find this interesting. I'm not sure how useful it is, but I do think that you can use this information as a trapper. I've seen, and I grew up with horses. We grew up raising half Arabian, half quarter horses. And when the coyotes started showing up, I did see evidence of coyotes would flip over and eat part of the horse manure that was out in the field. And I figured they were getting grubs, kind of like a chicken would do. And then later I've seen in Texas where they actually eat part of the cow manure. And I just assume to get grain or corn or whatever's there, but it could be the trace elements of that, because a lot of feed that's given to cows now, and because they take a plant and they can materialize it in such a different way, they're going to have minerals in there that a cow may not be able to digest. Just like, you know, a cow is an herbivore, so he eats grass and perennials and forage and stuff like that. Where me and you try to eat it, we can't really do that. And so, but they metabolize a lot of that, and a lot of the perennial plants pull up a lot of minerals, so this makes a whole lot of sense. Now, when he says cats one hand down, I'm going to assume, and I may be making, you know what that word means, but I'm going to assume that was bobcats. Because I don't think house cats would have any type of, you know, minerals in there. Because they eat, you know, most of them are going to eat dry or wet food, and it's not going to be that big a deal. But a bobcat, and I've seen, you know, cats do eat greenery. And they do maybe break down other animals and stuff that the coyotes can get minerals out of that they can't get on their own. I don't know. But to me, it's interesting that the cats won down on this. Now, what can we do with this as a trapper? Well, I mean, just thinking about it quickly, I don't think you're going to go out and whoop the world by just setting a trap on crap. You can use that as a form of, you know, guard blocks and flat sets and stuff like that. But looking at the study, if you had your choice and you can, and you're in an area that has cats, or you go somewhere that has cats, because I know down in Texas, the students would leave with buckets of cat droppings. Just seeing this, if you're using them at sets, maybe you'll have a better chance of success with the cats than you would using coyote droppings. You know, that's one thing to play out. Maybe, you know, run a couple of self-studies on yourself and run 50% cat, 50% coyote, and see if you have a higher percentage of cats using the cat over that. Now, you're not really going to know if you're catching them because they're going to eat it, or they're trying to get minerals out of it, or they're just curious because it's a different animal or a different predator. But that may be something, just one of those little feathers in the hat, maybe down the road may catch you some stuff you wouldn't have caught. And it's just one of those little interesting things not quite sure where it's going to go, but it's definitely interesting to know, because the more you know about an animal, the more in depth you get about an animal. And this is a lot of times where beginner trappers fall very, very short with someone that's been in the field a long, long time and been an observant trapper and trapping. And there's a lot of guys that's been trapping for a long time that don't observe anything. They just do the same thing over and over again. But an observant trapper picks up all this little stuff. And maybe if the cats have more value than any other type of dropping. What if you were to take a high quality gland lure like Booty Call Coyote or Booty Call Bobcat and mix in cat droppings with that? Maybe, you know, take some cat urine or bobcat urine depending on the dropping that you're using. Make a little slurry of it. And as you're using your lure, if you're, you know, you're going to have to use your head about this because droppings have a lot of bacteria in it that can really screw up a lure. So it's not something you're going to want to do now and then let sit on a shelf till trapping season, you know, if you're waiting till fall to do it. But if they do like eating it and they're more attracted to cats than whatever, you could maybe extend your a good high quality fresh, like Booty Call is, a fresh gland lure that smells like the butthole anyway, and you can add a volume way to maximize your volume. So if you had 2 ounces of Booty Call, maybe you could add 2 ounces of the Bobcat Scat to it before you went out and used it within a day or two or the morning of. May help you. It's definitely not going to hurt you. And the bacteria is not going to be an issue that quick because the bacteria is not going to be able to do anything by the time you're done using that set anyway. I do know that there's some guys that add droppings to gland lures. Some of them are pretty famous and have a lot of followers behind them. The issue though is time and the bacteria, and from a commercial point of view, I get really nervous doing that. But if you want to do it on your own, you can take a high quality gland lure, mix some cat droppings with it if you have them, make a slurry with it, and then you can, so if you're getting 2 ounces of Booty Call, you'd have 4 ounces of that out there, and the gland lure is still going to come through that dropping material anyway, and you may have a little bit advantage. Maybe it's 10%, 20%, 5%, no percent. It's not going to hurt anything whatsoever that I can see of trying that out. And then again, being a if you're going to be a really good trapper somewhere down the road, you got to start being observant and seeing if that seems to make a difference one way or the other. You might find out it may not make a difference on coyotes, but it may make a difference on gray fox or cats or red fox or coon or something like that, you know, and you just never know. If you're in a place, maybe just for giggles, if you're going out and you're on a piece of land that dairy farms and stuff are not common within 5, 10, 15 miles of you, people aren't running cattle like parts of Maryland that I've been at before, maybe just for giggles, what if you were to go to a dairy farm and get a 5-gallon bucket of the manure from the cows or from horses and pack a big deep hole with it and just see what happens? You never know till you try it. I mean, you really don't. I don't think, like I said, I don't think you're going to whoop the world with this, but it could be one of those things that you go out and every now and then you have a cow that's not wanting to cooperate with you and stuff like that, and it's one of those little bag of tricks that works. Sometimes it may get you that animal. It may be, you may find out that it works really well, or you may find out it works really well certain times of the year. And this may kind of go into part of what we're going to be talking about with the summertime coyotes, because if you have a female coyote that is nursing, she may be more receptive to a set like that than she would be any other time of the year, because maybe she knows, just because animals seem to know that type of stuff, that the trace elements in those droppings will help her have better milk and more healthy pups. Don't know till you try it. And I don't know of any study that's really done anything like that. But it is a very interesting thing to know. Not sure if it's quite science or not. Not sure if it can be reproduced or whatever. But it's one of those things, like I said, that this could be an extra quiver in your, an extra arrow in your quiver. It may help you out. Now, another thing I want to talk about before we get to the coyotes. Guys, failure is fine. Failure is perfectly okay. And anybody that's successful at anything is going to fail a lot. And the reason I'm saying this, and I'm not going to mention names or anything like that. I got a phone call, and a gentleman he's not a very experienced land trapper, very good at coon, and he put out some sets, and he had something come behind, and dug behind to get down in his hole to get his bait and lure, and he just looking at it from a trapper's point of view. Well, I've got the set. The pattern's in the front, the trap's in the front. The animal did not come in the way that I expected him to do. So from just observing and thinking about the animal, he put a trap behind the hole in line with the slot and re-bait and re-lured. I don't know if he caught anything or not by doing that. But it was, you could tell from his wordage, from asking questions on trapping forums, he got beat up pretty good about it because guys are saying you're wasting a trap. You know, this, that, and the other. It's not the, you know, not the best way to do it, this, that, and the other. And then he was like, did I do something wrong? Well, heck no, you didn't do something wrong. The animal told you how it wanted to work your set. And you put a trap to catch the animal. And then the question came up on, well, is it a waste of a trap to put a second one back there? Guys, that is the most, I'm going to be careful here because I don't want to sound mean. Closed-mindedness, that's about the gentlest way I know how to put that. That is the most closed-mindedness way to look at trapping I've ever seen. Because you have to break down what is trapping. Trapping is the action of doing something to catch an animal. Not to force an animal the way that you want to catch him, but to catch an animal. You take all the ego and all of the assumptions and all the I wants and all that completely out of the equation. When you go to set a trap, what is the main reason you're doing it? If it's for exercise, just start digging holes. If it's to catch animals, you've got to pay attention to what the animals are telling you, and you adjust from that point. So was it wrong for him to set a trap back? Absolutely not. If the animal comes on the opposite side of the back and digs now, I would say put a third trap in. Guys, if I'm on a job, and if you're looking at getting predator control, you really need to get this point through your head. I mean, you really need to pay attention to what I'm getting ready to say. If you're on 1,000 acres and you've got 12 coyotes that are working that ground and you're on a client's property, how you catch the coyote or kill the coyote is irrelevant. The goal is to catch or kill the coyote, period. Or whatever the animal there is. And the same thing for when you're fur trapping. This idea that setting two traps is somehow, you know, beneath a trapper, I don't know where that's came from, because I guarantee you, if you study the old wolfers that kick everybody's butt that's alive today, you'll see most of them use 2, 3, and 4 traps. Because percentage-wise, you only have so many animals that visit so many sets a night. Your failure rate gets way higher per trap when you do that. Because if you got 2 traps and you catch 1 animal, you're at a 50% failure rate. If you got 3 traps, you're at a 66% failure rate. At a set, and you're catching the animal. You can look at it as go, well, the set was 100%. Okay, the set's 100%, but per trap is you keep knocking that down. But if you're doing predator work or you're on a short time line, if you've got a job or something like that, and you only have so much time and so much ground that you can go out and trap, I want you to think about something. If you put out 100 traps, there's only a small percentage of those traps in an average area that's going to see an animal per night. I don't care how good the location is. I don't care how much sign is there. Coyotes do not do the same thing over and over again. It is not a computer program that just repeats, repeats, repeats. It can find something to chase. It can go a different direction. The wind can change. All this different stuff. So if you're running 100 sets and you actually had 30 coyotes find those 100 sets, which I don't personally think happens in a night. I really don't. Not unless you've got this crazy weather and storms moving in or moving out and stuff gets really active and really aggressive. You're not going to be running 30% of your traps even seeing an animal in a night. That's just not the way that the real world is. Let's say now, let's say you do have 30. And then you have a certain percentage of those animals that would get caught in a whatever your standard trap is, whatever your set is, a dirt hole, a Charlie Robbins, off to the side, you're following this person's advice or that person's advice or whatever. So you get half of those animals in there, you're at 15. Well, I don't even think that's very realistic, to be honest with you. I don't care what your skill level is. And if you get into areas with snow or sand or mud and you start paying attention, you'll see there's a lot more coyotes that come up to sets and get caught. And it doesn't matter who you are, it's just the way that it is. But if you could add two traps and catch 10% more animals, or three traps and catch 20% or 30%, look at your daily catch. Is that a waste of trap? I don't think so. And you got to think, you're already at a location. You already picked the best spot on where you think the best locations are at. If you've got a place that's got 20 just smoking locations, and you find the best place that you can guide that animal into that situation, and you cut off all avenues approach. At the end of the day, if someone's got to run 200 traps to catch what someone does with, or 200 sets to catch what someone does with 50 sets, who's being more efficient? Now, the one that's catching that on a smaller amount of sets, I guarantee you, use multiple traps. Their expenses are lower. Their time throughout the day is spent way more efficiently per the catch. Not per the trap, but per the catch. Huge difference there. The same thing goes with, if you've ever seen any of the old Charles Dobbins where he's raccoon trapping, watch the way he even sets up for raccoons. He may have three traps on a pocket, on different sliders and different things like that. And I bet if you were to follow him on his line, he would have certain traps that would miss and the next trap would catch and he would send it down the drowning wire because that was his style. And then another coon would come by and get caught in another one and going down. Or if he had two or three traps on each one of those pockets on something as simple as coon trapping, and he had one coon at each set, but he had one miss at each trap also at that set, his catch per set, his catch rate per being in the water or being at a stop is higher. And you're going to make more money with higher catch with less energy involved by doing it that way. If you could go to 30 trails that are smoking hot for coon and put 15 traps in there and you catch two coon per trail, and you're going to catch 60 coon in one night off of that few, if I've got the math right, because I'm doing this off my head, guys. But I think you'll see the point. Or you could run 200 miles and run 200 traps to catch 60 coon. Which one is being way more efficient? But you got to be willing to take the failure rate per trap to do that, to get a higher per set rate to do that. And if you see an animal doing something, it is never wrong to adjust to that. It is never wrong to adjust to that situation. It's wrong not to adjust to the situation. Because the animal is like giving you a roadmap on how to catch him, but you're going to have so much dogma in the way that your set is supposed to work or whoever told you to do it this way, that you're going to plant your feet and ball your fist and go, it'll work this way because I know it will. Well, the dogma part of that, I'm going to give you a little phrase when you're thinking about dogma. And dogma is something you just believe because you believe it and you're going to stand your ground on it. If you have a dogma, it's going to get run over by karma, especially in trapping. It is going to get ran over by karma. Because the animal doesn't care what you think. It doesn't even know that you think it. It doesn't even know that there's someone's out there trying to catch it. If it did, it wouldn't be around that set. So don't get hooked in your dogma. And when you start observing things, I promise you, you're going to have a lot of failures, because until you kind of figure some stuff out, you may read the sign wrong. You may read the intention of the animal wrong. It may be just a one-time thing, or you may see something catch an animal and then get all excited and want to redo your whole line for that one thing, and then you get your butt kicked. All that's happened to me. I can tell you that. And then when you're looking at maybe more efficient ways to do that, guys, I can promise you a lot of the successes that y'all have seen on YouTube and the magazines and the Wolfer Nation and the radio shows and the demos, what you're seeing are the successes of stuff that worked. What you're not seeing is the stuff that didn't work, because it didn't work. Why am I going to show you what didn't work? But there's a lot of failure that goes on. When you look at my logo and it says failure is not an option, that is to a landowner that is hiring me, because I'm going to do everything in my power, including a rifle if I have to, or run something over with my Jeep to make sure that that mission is accomplished. But I fail a lot all the time. And the more that I fail, the more that I learn. Because if you don't fail, and in our way of thinking in America, people are scared to death to fail. And that's the reason they stay in the same place with the same mentality, with the same catch, and the same thing for decades. Because they're afraid to fail. What if it doesn't work as good? Well, trial it and see. What if it works better and you don't do it because you're afraid to fail? Now, who's looking foolish at the end of that one? Failing is not bad. Everybody that does anything that matters to anything fails all the time. I fail all the time when it comes to trapping. But I'm always banking that information and building on that till I get to something, hopefully, that's better than what I was doing before. But if I wasn't willing to fail, I would keep doing the same thing over and over again, and I would be exactly doing what I was doing a decade ago. And to me, that's boring. And it's very inefficient. So don't be afraid to fail, and don't ever think you're doing something that's just wrong. You know, as long as it's ethically and morally okay, and it's legal, knock yourself out. Because you never know where it's going to go. I mean, I've tried some stuff in Texas with their laws I would never, ever try in Tennessee. Some of it worked, most of it didn't. So, I mean, don't be so afraid to fail, guys. And don't think that you're doing something wrong, because it's not the standard model that you see in the trapping industry. Because what the standard model is, I guarantee you, is very different than what it was 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 years ago. So somewhere in that's different. And this, humans being a tribal animal, you don't want to step outside of the comfort zone a lot of time, because you're worried you're going to be ridiculed. Well, the cool thing about trapping, most of the time, you're by yourself. So it doesn't really matter. If you're with a friend and he wants to give you a hard time about it, well, he ain't much of a friend. I mean, besides just joking around, being, you know, ball busting like guys do. But I mean, seriously, it's not that big a deal. And, you know, just human nature, you're afraid to do anything. And one of the worst things that I see in the modern America's way of doing things is you're looking for someone to tell you how to do something specifically with lists and diagrams and videos. And this is how you do it. I see it in all aspects of everything, not just trapping, but just America as a whole. How do you start a business? Well, you got to find someone that gives you a plan. Well, how do I get financing? And then you got to look up how you get financing, and you're going to have a plan. Then you're going to have someone like me saying you don't need financing, or you don't need to be doing the business, because if it can't cash flow, it's not going to work anyway, probably. But you're looking for lists, and you're looking for diagrams and very specific pieces of information. Well, the information that may work here in the mountains may be different than someone that's out in the Midwest or even out in the desert or down in Texas or down in Florida or up in Maine. So looking for that specific information may or may not even help you at all, but it could definitely hurt you. So what you're looking to do when you're going for information, guys, is kind of get a grasp, a understanding, and then you work out whatever the problem is logically in your own way, and then you go out and you try it. That's how you become really good at something wherever it is at that you're at. Not like getting a video that says do A, B, C, and D, and there's an animal standing there, because what's so frustrating to people is they do A, B, C, and D without understanding E, F, G, and H that the trapper just automatically assumes you know, and then what happened to him 5 years, 10 years ago, and what maybe someone took instruction from, whispered in his ear that you don't know about, is not happening on your A, B, C, and D, and you get frustrated. What you need to know is the general aspect of what that person is doing, and then you go out and you trial it yourself, and then you really get to rocking and rolling. That's when the trapping becomes interesting, is when you're willing to fail. All of a sudden now you're willing to succeed. Without willing to failure, there is no succeed. There's nothing that you do on your daily life that wasn't failed at to begin with. I've heard an example before that really put this in terms where I don't know where people as a whole got the grasp on the not failing thing. Imagine, and I've used this example before, imagine a toddler learning how to walk. If he stood up and took a step and fell down and everybody in the room got onto him and hollered and scolded and everything like that, that the kid got, you know, embarrassed and he didn't know what was going on and he was just trying to walk, and everybody, well, if you can't do better than that, just sit your butt down. If you can't walk, why are you even trying? But that's the way people look at trapping. You would never do that to a toddler. You would encourage that toddler to try again, and he's going to fail again. And you're going to encourage him, come here, and he's going to fail again. But eventually, through the failures, comes a success. And I want you to think about that as you're thinking about your line. Through the failures come the success. Now let's talk a little bit about summertime trapping. Because it is different and it's not different. And there is a, I think in the trapping industry for decades, there's been a lot of mojo thrown on summertime trapping, and a lot of, you know, you got to be this, you got to be that. I do think to be a summertime trapper, someone that has only trapped in the fall is going to get frustrated really quick unless they understand what's going on in the coyote's world at the particular time that they're going out to set traps. Because, you know, in the fall, you got dispersion and you got little pups and young animals running everywhere that are teenagers. And you know how teenagers act. They don't use their brain very well, and they'll do stupid stuff even though their instincts are telling them not to. And people, the part on a teenager of the brain that actually controls stupid actions isn't even grown up until they're about 18, 19, 20 years old. That's why, you know, when we were young, we did stupid stuff. You couldn't help it. Your impulse response was just wide open. And I'm sure with coyotes, it's got to be somewhat similar to the same thing. Because by the time you see a skinnable pup in the fall, it's not old. I mean, it's still basically a baby. And it's running around in unfamiliar territory. It's hungry. It's trying to figure things out. And it's more receptive to stimulus at that time because it's more desperate. Because it's not mature. Like you can get a young person to do something not thinking long term very easily and manipulate them, for the simple fact is they haven't been around to understand that short term may not always be the best term. And then you start going into fall and these coyotes start getting an education. I mean, you know, especially in states that have a lot of trapping. They're running from farm to farm. There's been studies where they move 200 miles trying to figure out where they want to live. all different type of patterns they use in different parts, you know, different directions, following rivers and interstates and different things like that. Well, if they come across people's crude coon sets that were never intended for coyotes, or fox sets that were never intended for coyotes, and weak traps and different things like that, they're going to start building their education at the same time. So early fall, it's a lot easier to catch coyotes, and which is when most people trap, because that makes sense. You do stuff when it's easier. As the winter progresses, these coyotes start getting an education, and they start packing up. Now you've got two animals that have been getting an education that are running together, and coyotes, just like dogs, they learn from each other, and one will guide one out of a situation. So if one coyote hasn't seen something before and he starts to mess around with it, the other one might nip it in the butt, especially females. But you've got all these things running around. They're getting harder to catch as the winter comes on. Their hormones are raging to the point later in the winter where now they're thinking about finding a territory for permanence and a mate, and they're horny. And food is not the main thing. That's when you start switching into gland lures and stuff like that. And then when they start to go denning, and I can't tell you when a coyote dens in your area, because it changes every year when they start going to den. It's weather related. It's your latitude. It's your longitude. All that's going to make a difference on what coyotes do in your specific area. There's a general rule, you know, rules and stuff like that, but it can be very different. So you don't know exactly when that's going to be from year to year. Dispersal can be as much as different as 2 weeks to a month from year to year. When they start going to go to den, it's a different time. And they're looking at something different. Now you're not dealing with the same coyote populations per square mile as you were in early fall. So setting on location in early fall is productive. Setting on location when they start denning up is not very productive. And I'll explain that to you in here in just a second. But you got to adjust. The coyotes are not the same in the fall as they are in the summer. They're the same coyotes, but their actions are different because where they're at in life is different. Just like if you went to a, if you were in a fraternity in college, your life revolves around what you do in fraternities. As you get older and you got three kids and a mortgage and all that other stuff, your actions and your what's going to be interesting to you is going to be very different than it was when you were in a fraternity in college. That's the way you got to look at these coyotes. Same animal, same person, just different times in their life. Now you have a female that until she lays pups, we'll go out and hunting. But it's also getting hotter. And if everybody's seen a house dog in the summertime during the day, and if it's really hot at night, they don't move a whole lot. They don't eat a whole lot. They don't have to. It's hot. Just like, you know, if we didn't have air conditioning, we probably wouldn't be doing as much in the summer either, especially in warmer climates. It's too hot to do it. Then they have pups. So you went from very active to hormones raging to now they're settling down in the suburbs. Now think about someone that lives in the suburbs. They have a house and they have a job and they got restaurants and stuff like that that they go to. If it was a college kid and he's running around with his friends after fall break, they may be doing a road trip from coast to coast and going hiking and everything, and they're running around everywhere. It's the same thing. In the suburbs, you're more controlled in where you go and what you do because it's more routine, and you don't have to go as far or do as much to get your needs met because you're not just trying to travel. So now, once they have pups, the mother takes care of the pups in the den, and she'll normally have a couple of dens. Two or three or four, because once the urine and the feces get really bad and the fleas and ticks and all that, she'll move from one to the other. They're normally not that far apart, but she will move the pups from time to time to get them out of unsanitary situations the best you can. Well, a very interesting thing happens when the mom has pups. Dad now is the main breadwinner. And he's going to go out and he's going to have to kill and bring back food to the mother. That's why you see a lot of fawns and stuff being taken back hold of the dens. If they can't do that, they do a lot of regurgitation, stuff like that. But the dad's bringing it out. Now, his mission is not to go out and do the massive road trip. His mission is to go find food and bring it back to feed the family. And his also other goal at that time is to make sure that he doesn't have other male or female coyotes coming into the territory, because they will kill the pup sometimes, or fight, or disturb the den. So that's his two missions in life at that point. And as the pups are born and they start getting a little older, this territory shrinks a lot. The male's only going to go as far as he needs to go to find food and make sure that no one is coming into the territory and mess with his family. So it's getting smaller and smaller. In the fall, they're running everywhere. Now the family groups are really tight and small. So setting on location during this time of year can be a very big waste of time. As the pups grow up, they're going to start moving around a little bit outside the den. And as they get older, you know, usually starting about August or so, they may take road trips with the parents, because the parents got to send them to school so they understand what's going on. They got to teach them to hunt, where to get water, and what they can eat and what they can't eat. And, you know, you don't go up to get pets from the farmer when he's pointing a gun at you, stuff like that. You got to teach them, because they're kids. So they go out and they start teaching them. And then as that evolves on out, there becomes a point, usually during dispersal, where those kids get kicked out by the parents and it starts over again in fall. So you have this cycle that's going on and on and on. And in the summertime, when you're going out through there, you're normally dealing with a very small, tight territory of a coyote, per se. Now, if you're somewhere that's in the east, it's very small. If you go out in places in the west where there's just not a lot of food, it can be quite large still, but it's very small compared to what it was in the fall. Down in Texas and places where there's a lot of food everywhere, Louisiana where there's a lot of food everywhere, I bet that what a coyote does in the summer may be curtailed to a quarter mile or less of a circle. Here in Tennessee, you got a lot of hardwoods. In Pennsylvania, you got a lot of hardwoods. There's not a lot of as many food in places like that. They're going to be a little bit bigger. If you get a coyote in an urban area or on the edge of urban areas or agriculture that has some diversity to it, still has tree rows and stuff like that, it's going to be tighter again. But if you're in mountains of West Virginia, it's going to have to be larger, because the food density is not there the way it is in these other situations. So you're going to have to figure out what that is. But what that means to you as a trapper in the summertime, either doing this to catch them for your deer, or doing it for you're doing predator control, or you're bored, or you just want to see if you can do it, whatever your reasons are, you're going to have to get as close to the den as possible, and you're not going to know where it is, especially in the east most of the time, without bouncing the coyotes, which means if you get too close to a den or you can actually find a den, you need to get your butt out of there. Because the female, well, if she has to physically grab the pups and run off with them, she will, or she will move the pups if they're big enough to move. So what you're looking to do in the summertime is you got to look for sign and not location. And when you start seeing sign, you need to start looking around and try to find, then you kind of back off again and you go to the left and right or north and south. Till you don't find sign, then you start seeing sign. Then you back off again. You're like probing a military installation. Because if it's only a half mile and you get in there and you start banging and baiting around, the female's going to move the coyotes on you. Now, if you're just trying to save fawns, that may not be a bad thing. You could go in and bounce coyotes and it'll save some deer. Everything depends on what you're trying to do. If you're trying to trap them, when you start getting into the sign of coyotes, you need to back off, because what you're trying to do is find those edges on the very end of where the coyote is going to be coming out to do whatever he's doing, either checking territory or finding food. If you're on a road, just for an example, and you're on somebody's farm, and on one whole end of the farm, there's no tracks, there's no scat. You may find one or two really, really old ones. And then maybe on the back side or the front side or wherever it is, you start coming into, you see tracks here and there and a couple of drop-ins, and that's where you stop. That is your battle line right there. If you go inside of that, you're going to get busted. But that right on the edge is where you can do what you need to do, is as soon as you start finding that. And then you may have to go on the back side of that farm in a different direction to you. No sign, no sign, no sign, sign. Okay, right here is where we're going to start. I'm not going to probably go more than 400 or 500 yards inside of that line looking for the best locations and the best ways to catch these cows. I'm not going to go really deep into that. And then you're going to kind of back out of that. And you'll, once you do this a few times, you'll start seeing, okay, here's the territory that these coyotes are living in at this time. And I've got to figure out how to way to stay in this edge effect of these coyotes. And that's where you start putting sets. But if a coyote can go out of its den and it finds a fawn, for instance, within 400 yards of its den, it's not going to go to the edge of that territory until it needs more food. And later in the year, July, June even, depends on where you're at, he may have to start extending that, because just like, you know, if you got a piece of ground, say 20 acres, and you're trying to hunt deer to feed your family, eventually you're going to have to go out past that 20 acres and get that. So it's going to change later on. Plus, he's going to need more meat because the pups are getting bigger and they're teenagers now, and they're, you know, they want to eat a lot, like all parents will tell you that teenagers do. So all this is going to have to be adjusted for and changed. And you'll start seeing sign in different places. You'll know they're expanding that territory back out. Then you just try to stay on that edge the best you can. And this is where it gets really hard to explain this to somebody until they get the experience of bouncing coyotes when they didn't want to because they got too close. Or they're sitting on locations just because in the fall or the winter, the deer hunter saw coyotes here, but now there ain't no sign and there ain't no coyotes here. You're trapping ghosts. And so you start looking for the sign, you start finding the sign, and you're not going to have the amount of coyotes on any one place at the time. So your catch is not going to be as high. But if you're doing predator control work or trying to save deer, turkeys, it's way more advantageous at this point. Because you're doing more good. Because if you're on 100 acres and you catch 12 coyotes in the fall, there's a good chance not one single of those 12 coyotes are going to be there when they're going to be eating the game off that land anyway. They're just moving through. They're just easier to catch. Now, if you off 100 acres and you catch 3 coyotes, now you've done a tremendous amount of job, because the food that they're going to be taking when they need to take it is going to be on that particular ground or property or inside of that zone. Now you've really elevated what you've done compared to the land and the catch that you're doing. So, and the other thing about trapping coyotes this time of year is time. You've got to be patient. There's no way to force summertime coyotes to do anything. If you can use snares and use blind sets and you're somewhat efficient of it, I would be running 50% of those to lured sets every single time. If there's a lot of trails and I can see coyotes coming down them, I may go almost completely blind set and flat set at that time. During this time, though, very interestingly, because especially when you start getting in July, buried bait sets actually start becoming very productive. Like a whole beaver that's staked down. You dig a hole and you put the whole beaver in the hole. I mean, not like a dirt hole, but just a like a trough. You stake him down, cover him up with leaves so it doesn't spoil that fast. The coyotes will have no trouble finding it. It's a good chunk of meat. It's a lot of nutrition for the mama and the pups. A lot of times the male coyotes will really play with a set like that, where earlier in the year, before the pups come, the male coyote may not mess with that. And I know it's counterproductive to thinking that they got to eat, and they do have to eat, but they don't eat very much. In the summertime, they can eat grasshoppers and bugs and slugs, and they eat all kind of stuff. They eat blackberries, they eat all kind of things besides just meat. And it's hot. Just like me and you, we eat more heavy food in the winter than we do in the summer. It's just a natural way of doing things. But you're going to have time. And this is where most people think it's harder to catch them, because you're not having the daily activity that you did in the fall. So you're going to have to be patient. And you're going to have to understand that going in. And you're going to have to explain to the landowner that too. Because if you oversell what you can do for the summertime, and you oversell the amount of coyotes you can catch, and they're not there, you're not going to catch them. Or if you, well, I'm just going to go put these out and this should be done in about a week or so, you're probably going to have a very upset landowner if you're doing predator control work. You're going to have time. Most sets in the summer don't even start working for a week or so. And then it's mismatched and all over the place, and it's one here, then 3 or 4 days it's one there. But for the function of what you're doing, it's way higher than catching a bunch of them, because they're not there anyway. You're hurting a family group way more during this time of year to do it. So you're gonna have to explain that, and you're gonna have to accept that. And when you go out for a week and you don't see any coyotes, it's easy to get discouraged. You're spending money on expenses. You're spending time and you're not seeing anything, and you're just going to have to suck it up. That's just the world that it is with coyotes. The other thing you got to deal with in the summer is you're going to have rot of baits. You're going to have stuff drying out if you're not prepared for it. And you're going to have ants and bugs and all this stuff that's going to start screwing with your lure and bait, which becomes an issue. Because if you go up and you keep adding bait every day, just the phobic nature of a coyote will keep him away from that set. No matter how hungry he is or how bad he wants whatever's in there, his instincts, because you're dealing with adults now, are going to go, I don't think that's not a, something's wrong there. Every day I come back and this smell keeps getting stronger. Now it's different. And yesterday it was something else, and I ain't doing that. So you gotta think about that. So you gotta start thinking about how and why you can keep and use things that the ants aren't gonna destroy quickly. And that's gonna be a journey that you're gonna have to figure out of how you do that. Because ants will eat lure and eat bait, especially in the south. I mean, it gets crazy. And you'd be no ants there. You can put a pint of whatever baits you want in there in 2 days. It's gone. Absolutely gone. And if you think about, ants eat solid more than anything else. How do you get around that? You're going to have to figure that out for your own. Trust me, it's a cool journey to figure that out. Because my goal is not to tell you specifically how to do anything. My goal, like I said, is to get you in the right direction so you can figure things out. And maybe even better than I figured out. So you're going to have to figure that out. Always, always, always set on sign. Because without sign in the summer, you're probably wasting your time. And if you do catch a few, that's about all you're going to catch. So you got to set on sign in the summer, because you don't know where their den's at, and you got to find that sign. And the biggest thing about it in the summertime, guys, is don't get discouraged. You know, I know we live in a microwave world. Everybody wants to do the things if they go do something that they get instant results immediately, and trapping is not that way. It can be, in certain situations. Summertime coyote trapping is not that situation. A lot of times, fall coyote trapping, depending on your populations, are not going to be that way. But it's 100 times worse in the summer, because you're dealing with an animal that's lethargic. He's only going to do what he has to do because he's hot. And he's got a mission, and he's in a very small area. So it's just going out and running around the countryside and setting crossroads and stuff like that. Unless there's sign there that's fresh, you're probably trying to trap ghosts that are no longer there. And it's hard to trap a ghost. So you can't be discouraged from that. Now, we're running on 51 minutes so far. So I'll probably save the summertime beaver for next time. Because they're totally different in that too. I mean, but if you want to go out, and I can tell you, if you can go through the non-discouragement and you keep focused on the end goal of the goods you're doing in the summertime when you're trapping on a place for a particular reason for coyote control, you will, fall trapping becomes a whole lot easier because you got more animals, you got more movement, you got more younger coyotes to deal with, this, that, and the other. So if you get into the summertime, especially doing predator control work, don't try to be, you know, Billy Bad Butt when it comes to your capability starting out, because you're going to have a learning curve, and I don't care who you are. And even if you've been doing it a long time, I've been in situations where someone's hired me on a job and I ain't found a cow track or a scat on 1,800 or 2,000 acres, and in the fall they're running everywhere. Now, the landowner is not going to believe you or understand or anything like that, because he, again, lives in a microwave world where if he pays somebody to do something, then it's got to get done because he's paid somebody to do something. So one of the things, if you're getting into predator control, you better look at the job with the landowner, especially if you can with the landowner, and start riding around and going, dude, I ain't seeing any sign at all. Well, I know they're here. Well, unless they're flying, where are they? Maybe this is something we need to do closer to fall when you actually have coyotes on your property. Something like that. Because you don't want to set them up to be discouraged, and you don't want to set yourself up where you get a bad reputation. So summertime coyotes can be a game breaker for some people just because they try to treat it like fall and it ain't gonna happen. If you're lucky enough and you're right in the middle of you get in some really high population areas of coyotes, even in places where people don't think about it, you may have five or six dens within a couple of miles of you just by the terrain. Well, yeah, now you're talking with several coyotes. You can be a hero then. If you don't have a den and you're not on the edge of what they're doing, you're not going to be a hero. Now you're just working. And that's what separates a professional and the hobby guy when it comes to this. You're going to have to be able to figure all that out by yourself. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a business opportunity. It's not trapping related. But if nothing else, think about, because I'm telling you, everybody listening to the show needs to start a business, and not start a business the way that most people think about starting a business or having a business. If you want to be very stable in your life, don't be an A something, ADC, one ADC trapper or an ADC business. You need to have one main thing that you do and several smaller things you do, and if one kind of gets screwed up, you can fill in with the other one and go about it. So you're better off coming up with four or five smaller businesses that are way more sustainable over the long term instead of having just one thing. Like if you're just a welder and you just weld whatever, and that market goes down, now you're in trouble. But if you did ADC part-time and you were a welder most of the time, you could fall back on the ADC to match into that, or fur trapping to match into that. Or if you're really good at fishing, maybe you 1 year you only take out five or six people that wants to go have a guide to catch striper up next to a dam, and you're really good at it, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden you see that whatever your main, because something that's totally out of your control or the market's changed or whatever, if you're building social capital in all these little businesses, you can grow them really quickly to generate money. But if you're just one thing, you get in trouble. And from my point of view, for a trapper, you need to have a secondary business that is separate from trapping and seasonal. I know it would scare most women to death and most people to death. The worst thing that's ever happened to Americans is pension plans and 40-hour work weeks and having a singular skill that they do at a job, because those skills can go away. Ask the horse buggy makers. I hadn't seen any of them in a while. They didn't think that they was going to have to find something else to do either. Right now in California, they have a drought, and they're not going to fix the drought because the government's blaming the farmers, and the farmers are blaming the people that are flushing their toilets, and the lobbyists are seeing who can raise the most money to get the politicians to do what they want to do, and they're looking for a tax system to generate more water and restrictions and all this. Guys, California is 38 million people that live on the edge of a desert. No matter what you want to think about California, the jokes we do about the fruits and nuts and stuff out there that are the people and the fruits and nuts that are on the trees, they're on the edge of a desert, and they've got completely out of scale of what a desert can do. And because the government doesn't think about such things until there's a problem, there's no quick or easy fix. So from someone that lives in Illinois or Tennessee or Georgia or Mississippi or something like that, with the drought going the way that it's going and the politicians doing what the politicians doing, and the farmers pointing at the homeowners, and the homeowners pointing at the farmers, and the people that want to save the fish are pointing at everybody that wants a dam, that wants to flush their toilets, and everybody's pointing fingers at everybody. There's going to be some adjustments in the future from California. Now, California grows most food crops, not soybean, not corn, not wheat. They grow food crops, what people eat on a daily basis. 80% of all the organic food that's sold in grocery store comes from two farms in California. That's hard to imagine, but it is statistically true. 80% of all the organic food that's on a grocery store shelf comes from two farms in California, where they've completely screwed up the soil and they're running out of water. Now, regardless of your view on organic style food, think about the availability of people that are going to want to have food that they're used to eating if it keeps going downhill in California. So someone that wants to trap full time can really get into the feeding, growing food that people eat that are not processed, and you don't have to send them to a bin or something to sell them. You sell directly to the customer, where you can build a lot of social capital and a lot of goodwill and a lot of coolness for doing that. You can make really, really good money. There's people right now, and I've said this before, but I think it's going to get more obvious in the upcoming years. So someone that wants to trap in the winter, this is a perfect fit. If you like gardening or growing food. And most people that's never gardened or grown food, if they get out of trying to replicate what a big farm does on a little scale and grow a little scale that grows a lot more food per square meter, it gets really cool, because all of a sudden, if you've got a yard and you've got a tenth of an acre or a half an acre that you could put in production, there's people right now, a lot of people, that are making $30,000, $50,000, and $80,000 off a half acre in high-intensive gardening. What customers are fighting for the product. Restaurants are fighting for the product. Now, for a trapper, you could go the route that I did when I was building swimming pools. You build swimming pools in the summer, you go trapping in the winter, you've got money from one or the other, everything equals out. It's a lot more stable than just being a pool builder or just being a trapper. When I went to just the trapper route, it got very hairy all the time because I didn't have the different incomes coming in at different times. That was a mistake of a young, egotistical man that was determined to do something without really thinking it through. I was just going to be a trapper come hell or high water, and I was. But there was just as much hell as there was cool water throughout that journey. If I would have just did the pool liners or pool opening and closings for the pools, spring and early fall and some stuff in the work, it would have been so much more gentler in my life and on my wife's security needs. That I promise you. But if you're wanting to get into the trapping the way a lot of guys say they are, and you see, and you start looking at the world through the opportunity that's out there, California is going to destroy itself. It may be a couple of years, it may be 5 years, it may be 10 years. You don't know. When it starts really going chaotic out there, they're going to start dumping money and people are going to get more crazy. But they're not going to fix it because they're not looking to a solution of the problem. They're looking at a solution of government, and that ain't never going to work. But that gives an opportunity for someone that lives in a totally different area, that if the scarcity of whatever's going on in California and somebody wants organic tomatoes or lettuce or microgreens or whatever it is, and all of a sudden now they cost three times as much because there's scarcity of those coming out of California, an entrepreneur sits back and goes, you know, that really sucks for them guys in California. But from an entrepreneur's point of view, now we have an opportunity. And the opportunity is to fulfill a need that the customer is going to want. And you could sell it at the price that it used to be and still make really, really good money, because an organic tomato that sells for $2.50, $3 a pound, that's $3 a tomato. You plant several of those things out, you've really got it what it is. And I promise you, if you think about doing this, you need to look at permaculture. You need to look at high volume gardens. There's a place out in California. These people are growing, I don't know, it's like 600,000 or 60 tons or some crazy amount off 1/10 of an acre. And they ain't got no grass nowhere because it ain't making them no money. But they're making a really good living. I just listened to a podcast that he only owns a little bit of land, and he farms people's gardens and other people's houses. He makes $80,000 bring home a year in the summer by doing that. Now, if you're wanting to get into trapping, it'd be pretty nice to have that money sitting there. And you know, then you can think in the back of your mind, if the fur market goes sideways on me, I'm still okay because I got this going. And you can expand on what you need to at what you need to. But that opportunity, guys, is going to be coming to people's directions. And the people that see it coming are going to be the one that's really going to make the biggest lick on it. If California, with the vegetables and the fruits and stuff like that, part of the reason I grow all the stuff that I grow now as far as the fruit trees and stuff like that, is one, I like eating it. I like knowing where my food comes from. I know there's nothing on it that I don't want to eat. And when the opportunity comes, which it's coming, and you will see, your kids are going to look at you kind of funny. I promise you this. Farmers of the future are going to be the ones making a lot of the money. Not the farmers of the day, because they're sold as commodity. But the direct selling, small scale, high intensive farmers are going to be the one that's making the most money, because everybody that you see in them cars going down the road eat. And the people that grow it have free food. And as scarcity happens because of stuff in California, the prices are going to rise, which means whatever you're doing for a living now is going to go not as far, because you got to buy food. But if you're growing the food, it's basically free and you get to sell it. I'm not saying everybody out there needs to be an overgrown gardener or a farmer, but just look at things that's going on in the world as far as a business opportunity to get your root system out there so you're more stable, So if you want to do something like trapping, it's not that chaotic in your life. So just watch what's going on in California. It's going to get worse. Food's going to get way more expensive, and it's a huge opportunity for someone that's looking for seasonal work that can do a high quality product that's way more cooler than someone getting a truck off, getting a tomato off of a truck from California, when the person can come out and see your garden and buy directly from you, and you get full retail price and not 10 or 20% of retail price. It's just a shift that's going to be happening. I have no doubt you're going to see this more and more and more, because as people get more educated about some of the stuff going on in the world, their local food is here to stay, because that's the way it's been forever. The only time it hadn't been that way is in the last, since about the 50s. And it's unsustainable the way that it's going now, and it's going to switch back. You're still going to need corn and soybean and wheat. But as far as food and vegetables, it's going to be people that are going to make good livings right where they're at. And I think that's pretty cool. Now, I want to end on a dichotomy alert, because I've been talking about this, and I thought this would be just kind of interesting. The riots in Baltimore, nothing to do with trapping. Everything to do with dichotomy. You got white people that aren't there that are saying the police ought to shoot them. You got black people that are there and aren't there that saying that the police the problem. And this, that, and the other. So you've got black people. And I watched the thing with a reporter. I think he's Cuban or Hispanic. Geraldo or whatever his name is. He got talking to one of the protesters, and the black protester was all mad because white people didn't give a damn about black people. Well, first off, it's not white people's responsibility to care about black people. It's black people's responsibility to care about black people, which would solve a lot of the problem of the riots in Baltimore just on its own. But the dichotomy of that is, why are the people the way that they are? Why are they thinking, whether the abuses are real or not, and if you don't think that there's any abuses from police, I think you're being naive. Just because they're in a situation with a group of people that's out of control because of the way that they've been manipulated, basically, for votes and through dichotomy. Well, you can be on one side where you just go in there with the National Guard and machine guns and put the rioters down, or you can be on the other side and you can, the black people are victims, and you're going to sit there and argue with each other. For one, if you don't live in Baltimore, it ain't your circus. Don't get excited over it. And the black people are going to point towards the white people. The white people are going to point towards the black people. Police are going to be pointing at the politicians. Politicians are going to be pointing at the white people. Everybody's going to point at everybody, but no one's asking the right questions. Why does such a large group of people and so many situations just like that feel like they're being dumped on by society? That's a bigger question. Why are they in the situation that keeps a lot of them? And I'm not making excuses for any of the people that live in hoods. I don't know why they don't leave personally. But why? What policies have been put in place to do that? That's a little more interesting questions that gets beyond the finger pointing. Who are the political leaders of these cities? What are the promises being made to them? Who's telling one side that the other side is the problem? And you'll find out it's not the black people nor the white people. It's the people that stay in charge because the white people and the black people are pointing fingers at each other. Now, if the black people and the white people did a left and a right face and looked up at the people that are putting this dichotomy out there, this would go away very, very quickly. It's just dichotomy. It's what it is. So when you see these situations going on, step back away instead of doing a knee-jerk reaction and think about it. And that's when you start asking these really interesting questions that go to some very scary places sometimes, but they're always going to be thought-provoking, and it's not knee-jerk. Because I can ask 20 people today about the riots, and they're going to say exactly what they saw somebody say on TV without thinking about one side or the other, or what's going on or the other, or thinking beyond just the riots right now. And as soon as the riots are over and everybody's finger pointing, the same people that made the policies are in place, there's a lot of destroyed property, a lot of upset people, and it's going to continue on until it happens again. Just something to think about. Look at all this stuff different, guys. And when you start doing that, now you start becoming a more happy trapper, because you realize it ain't your circus. I mean, that phrase actually says, not my circus, not my monkeys, but that's probably the wrong thing to say at this time, because somebody would take that wrong. But I'll just say, it's not my circus. If you live in an area like that, I would suggest you leave. Get out of the system. If you're out of the system no longer matters to you at that point. Build your own life. Do some cool stuff. Make sure that you're not asking anybody for anything. And a lot of this stuff that everybody worry about just goes away. And then you can get down to the important things. Family, trapping, friends, relaxation, not having high blood pressure, not having all that, not arguing with people that can't change anything either. Just a better, happier trapper if you get out of the economy game. All right, guys, I will see y'all next week. And depends on what I've got coming up. We may be talking about summer beaver trapping and some of the idiosyncrasies of that, or we may go somewhere else. Who knows? That's a long time from now. Y'all have fun out there. Just think about what you're doing. And whatever you're going to do, guys, be a beast at it. All righty. Bye.